The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
It was very difficult, in part because we all came at it with our own backgrounds and experiences, and they were different.
Wayne Hogan talks about the team of trial lawyers learning how to work together to win the 1997 Florida tobacco settlement, and how he uses creative thinking techniques to help win cases.
There is a mechanism, a process that people can go through in order to be more creative in the way that they look at their cases and understand ways to shape a case.
And the case that made a big impact on his staying power in a career of more than 45 years.
From that, I've taken a career lesson of always wanting to listen to my client, because sometimes the clients see the end result as being the justification of their willingness to come and trust you.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. As one of the 9 Florida trial lawyers hired by the state to fight big tobacco in the 1990s, Wayne Hogan became part of the glue that held the elite team together. He worked to smooth the disparate legal approaches and personalities to help shepherd an eventual $13 billion judgment against the tobacco industry, the largest of its time. He also brought the first asbestos case involving punitive damages to trial in Florida, and was one of the first lawyers to become designated in consumer law. A past president of the Florida Justice Association, Wayne has won 4 of its major awards: the Victor Tipton, the Al J. Cohn, the B.J. Masterson, and the Perry Nichols Award, the FJA's most prestigious. Wayne Hogan sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in December of 2017 to discuss his career-long fight unearthing secret documents, how elections have consequences in trial law, and why he's a big supporter of public education.
Wayne, you were one of the 9 trial lawyers who brought and settled the famous big tobacco lawsuit on behalf of the state of Florida back in the mid-1990s with an eventual $13 billion judgment, the largest of its time. That must have been a tremendous experience for you.
What it was an opportunity for lawyers who had known of each other over the years, but with the exception of a couple of us, W.C. Gentry and I had practiced together earlier. With that exception, we had not worked together in cases on the same side during the years. So it was a great opportunity for us to try to meld our approach to cases together in order to achieve an important result for the people of Florida. And so it was a wonderful opportunity to do. It was very difficult, in part because we all came at it with our own backgrounds and experiences, and they were different. And when you try to put that together and then you are building a team and making assignments among yourselves as to what to do, who's going to cover what, that had its challenges, but it also, in the end, as you can tell, was very successful. People talk in terms, by the way, of the settlement being a $13 billion settlement, but from what I recall, in terms of the continuing amounts that are being paid by the tobacco industry on into the future is really, I think, estimated to be more like $17 billion that they will pay. They've paid going on 9 or 10 at this time, but they'll still be paying in the range of $350 to $400 million on an annual basis to the state of Florida. And here's hoping that the money will be used in the way that it was intended to be used.
Sure, and what great societal benefit, too, because they can chronicle the number of smokers who are no longer smoking because of that. I mean, there were significant changes in tobacco advertising and a lot of other impacts that that case had.
To his everlasting credit, Governor Childs insisted on that. He would not have settled the case if it were not for the ability to achieve these other health-related and prevention of teenage smoking, that's where they start. He insisted on that, and so he would have foregone the dollars if he had not been able to require in the settlement the other changes with regard to marketing, with regard to teens, the health-related matters that were addressed in the settlement.
And what an innovative approach, too, going on racketeering as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting development. There was a statute, which Fred Levin or others may have talked about, which made an amendment to the Third Party Medicaid Liability Act, and we traveled on that statute. But as time went, we also learned that the statute had its complications after it was ruled on by the Florida Supreme Court by a 4-3 majority and approved, but with limitations. As time went, we found it, except for one statute, which was a different statute, we were not able to pursue punitive damages. The court felt that if the legislature in passing the statute intended for there to be punitive damages, he ruled they would have done so.
Right.
But because the judge had seen the punitive damages proffer that we made, which was basically the size of a wall of notebooks, we were in the courtroom when one day he walked in as we were moving up with the trial date in sight and asked the question of, does the state intend to amend to add a racketeering count?
This is the judge.
He did. So he had seen what from his background and experience, and I think he had been a judge in a criminal law division as well, he saw enough there to tell him there was a question that he ought to ask. And then those of us on the team talked with the Attorney General Butterworth and the governor's office, and the answer to us was yes right away, and pretty soon it was the answer from everyone. And so then we amended, and we were picking the jury to go to trial on a racketeering allegations in that complaint.
Wow. You've also made a big, big difference with your special expertise in asbestos lawsuits. You brought the first asbestos case involving punitive damages to trial in Florida a decade before the big tobacco case. Tell us about the difference that case and subsequent ones have made to consumer protection.
The story of the asbestos companies was just beginning to be revealed. There were documents that had long been secreted by the industry that finally people managed to get out. Once they got out, I was in the case with Ron Motley, whose firm was involved in later in the tobacco case for Governor Childs. Together we were in the Janssen's case and seeking punitive damages, where what we did was show a history that ran all the way back to the 1930s on their own typewriters, mm-hmm. their own correspondence, their own communications, and some testimony by people who were there, their medical director and others who were there at the time. The end result was, it said, if you dig hard enough to get the documents and get the story of what went on, then juries have the ability to try to make a difference by returning a verdict for punitive damages, not just to punish the company, the particular companies involved, but also to serve as an example to others. And that has consistently been a part of Florida law over the years. There have been some changes, tweaks, and a variety of things. But that standard that was set in the Janssen case against Johns Manville Sales Corporation still is the standard today. The only difference is that there's a requirement to prove the punitive damages case by clear and convincing evidence, whereas in Janssen's, the standard was proving it by the greater weight of the evidence.
Wayne, let's go back to the beginning. What made you want to be a lawyer?
It's an interesting path, probably very familiar, though, but maybe many lawyers have had that. A lawyer, later to be a judge, Frank Upchurch of St. Augustine, where I grew up, came to my civics class, and he talked about the important role that lawyers play in their communities, how they help people resolve disputes between themselves in a civil way, the defense of someone whose rights are at stake in one way or another. And I thought that I was interested in going into public office, but running for office someday. But hearing him explain that helped me understand that that was the right path to be able to make a change for the good, for the better in people's lives through individual cases, whether in the end I decided to take a broader path or not. As it happened, these cases that you and I've been talking about, they actually have had their broad impact, the tobacco litigation, the asbestos litigation, the ability to make policy changes come into existence as a result of holding companies responsible. So if you go all the way back, it was because a lawyer came to my civics class and talked to us about the Bill of Rights, the importance of lawyers, the resolution of cases, the importance of civility and professionalism, and that appealed to me, and so that's how I decided to become a lawyer.
And you grew up in a family where they respected the little guy. Your father ran the union at Southern Bell in St. Augustine there.
He was the union steward and then president of the communication workers local.
What influence did that have on you growing up?
I can recall when I was sworn in as president of the Florida Justice Association, I had to say to the Chief Justice who was there to swear me in, I had to make an apology because my dad on the line during the strike that occurred when I was in junior high school, it said, "Ma Bell is a cheap mother." So as I was making that little talk there, I had to say, "Excuse me, Madam Chief Justice, but that's one way that I understood my dad to be getting it across to me that it's important for working people to be able to stand up for better wages, better working conditions, and that those things don't just come along through what the government might require. Because, frankly, you're subject to changes in administrations that sometimes can weaken the ability of administrative agencies to do what they oftentimes are able to do to protect the consuming public, whether it's dealing with access to the internet the way that we're talking about these days,
sure,
or environmental protection the way we're talking about these days. All those kinds of questions. Elections have consequences, and sometimes changes occur in the administrative bodies that can negatively affect their ability to help. That's why it's always important for people to be able themselves to stand up for what they believe in and what could make their situation and those around them better.
Were there other lessons you learned growing up that prepared you for law or that have guided you during your long established career, now going on 45 years?
As I hope many people are, and maybe most, although that's changing too, a big fan of public education. I had the greatest experience I think that anybody could have in their public school system, the one that was always fostering the betterment of the kids from the day that I can recall a day that I went home at recess at my first day at school in St. Augustine, third grade. I thought, gosh, that's the end of the school day. Instead, it was just recess, but we only lived a block and a half from school. My mother sent me back, and there was Mrs. Wicking, my third grade teacher, with arms open and a smile on her face, welcoming me back as opposed to scolding me, because she wanted me to feel a part of that school. And throughout the rest of my time in the St. John's County school system, it was that kind of approach. The end result of that is that we have scholarships that are named after our superintendent, Doug Hartley, who helped prepare that county for the change into an integrated school system, because my time frame there, I graduated in 1965 from high school.
Part of desegregation.
And so he prepared it, and I would like for people, graduating students who are receiving scholarships to go to college, to remember or have a reason to remember the work that other people did before them, including Superintendent Hartley. Did the same sort of thing with my debate coach, Dean Overturf, at St. John's River, what's now called St. John's River Community College, St. John's River Junior College, where he gave me what I needed at that time, which were skills in speaking with people and talking about subjects that mattered, because I was not a natural speaker, didn't have that much experience from that standpoint, and signed up for the course, and it turned out that it was in a small town in northeast Florida that had one of the best debate programs in the state of Florida and throughout the southeast.
Wow.
Gene Deckerhoff, who's the voice of Florida State Seminoles, was a state champion. I think it was 2 years. He graduated, I think, the year before I came to St. John's. And, of course, I just recently had an opportunity when he was here in Jacksonville to tell the story of how they took me around to look at his trophies for his success, and that told me I was in a good program.
Well, and you and your wife continue to be big supporters of the state community college system as a result.
Well, it matters. Yeah. It matters just as your solid school systems, public school systems do.
Wayne, who was your mentor in law? Did you have a mentor?
I started after a brief stint in the public defender's office in Tallahassee for it was full-time work for half-time pay. And it was because David Fonville had arranged for the job, but he wasn't in a position to take it yet. And I had 6 months to do before I went to Fort Benning for my active duty for training.
Okay, and you had just graduated from FSU Law School.
Right. So I started there, but then I had the opportunity to go to the Bedell firm here in Jacksonville, which had been long established since the 1860s or so, back in the late 1800s, and Chester Bedell was still there. Nathan Bedell was there, and I was able to learn from them, and Bob Smith, Earl Zimmer, and others. That opportunity was awfully important, and one of the people that was ahead of me in the personal injury aspect of the practice was W.C. Gentry. Who you may speak with in the course of this series.
You bet. He's a fellow Titan.
Although W.C. is just a year or so older than me, he was a mentor to me because he had been involved in this work before. And I've told people and told Governor Childs as well, Gentry is the most complete lawyer that I've ever known in practice because he can do it all. And if I were to say, even though he's just a little bit older than I am, as a mentor in terms of how you approach cases, what you do, how you think about them, how to present them. W.C. might not have heard me say it just that way, but I consider him to be a mentor.
That's wonderful. How did you go about honing your trial skills as a young lawyer?
Well, if you go back in time, the first was to be able to speak, and I wasn't in a position to speak in a public forum. I had an experience at Boys State, which you probably know about, from high school, went there. And in that situation, when you're in Boys State, you meet the fellows on the hall and get elected to the town councilor or something like that during the course of that week. But at some point, you're expected to go out and make a public speech. And so I did that, running for some office, and froze. Never had really been called on to do that. And so I went back and said to myself, I've got to learn something about this, and that's why I signed up for debate courses at the end of high school, but also that two-year time at St. John's. So that was one of the key things that I did to prepare myself. But the other was over the years to make a study of the field of creative thinking, paying attention to the fact that it's not just enough to say think outside the box, because nobody has a plan for how they think outside the box. But there is a mechanism, a process that people can go through in order to be more creative in the way that they look at their cases and understand ways to shape a case, and understand that sometimes there's information that you just haven't been able to find, but if you dig hard enough, you'll be able to find it. In the first case that I tried when I was here at this firm with Tom Brown and Jim Terrell, difficult case for an old friend of one of my partners, Tom Brown, and I had read a book, and the book was Louis Neiser's My Life in Court, and in it, he talks about something that is crucial. And that is what he calls the rule of probability. It is a concept that says the jury decides the case by deciding, in the kinds of cases that we do, mm-hmm. what probably happened. There's typically not going to be a videotape. There's going to be a variety of different points of view or witnesses that might have seen it. A whole range of different kinds of cases, something that happens in the hospital. But that concept of the rule of probability, staying on it until you find the key that will help the jury make a determination as to how did this probably come about, and that's really what's required in our cases, the greater weight of the evidence.
Right.
And that was in that very first case that I tried. I actually talked to the jury and said, there's this concept that I've learned, and it tells me how you're going to decide this case. And here's the reason that I think you should decide that it probably happened the way that my client and I are talking with you about.
Wow, so you actually put yourself in the role of a juror for a few minutes to walk them through.
I did that and let them in wow. on the fact, openly let them in on the fact that they're engaged in that process so that they could make a determination when the facts, if you just looked at it without getting underneath it, would look as though my client had pulled out from a side road into the right-of-way of another driver that was on the U.S. 90 federal highway.
Did you win that case?
We did.
You betcha. What's the most rewarding part for you after 45 years so far of being a plaintiff's attorney?
There's always the great feeling of knowing that someone truly needed someone else stand up on their behalf. And then when you succeed in that and they know that you gave it your all, that is about the best feeling that you can imagine, where they know that you've gone to the mat for them. The truth of the matter is, even if you don't succeed in the case, if you've done it the right way, they'll understand that they got their time, their opportunity, their day in court, and it was because a lawyer was willing to take it on with no guarantee that they were going to get paid by the hour, but instead were going to be paid on a contingent basis. If we didn't succeed in the case, yes, the client lost, but the lawyer lost as well from the standpoint of the financial aspect of it. But the client knows that somebody stood up for them. And when you can promise the client that that is what you're going to do, that to me is the thing that is most rewarding, because you are enabling the system to do what it ought to do, and that is provide an even playing field for anybody that is in that situation.
And those are people often in very dire circumstances who need a friend, who need an advocate, need someone to go to bat for them.
They are almost always people who could never possibly afford to pay somebody by the hour to do the work that we do.
Certainly.
And so from my standpoint is giving those people an opportunity to stand up to some of the most powerful entities in the world.
Any one particular key to your success?
Work. And so perseverance, hard work, because it's also been said that talent is never enough. People can have talent, but unless they work at their craft, unless they persevere, learn the basic underpinnings of the law, where these different principles come from, why they're there, understand the rules of evidence, the rules of civil procedure, and why they're there and what they're intending to do. Unless they do all of those things and then work their case, persevere in their case, they're not likely to be successful. Talent is not enough.
How do you handle disappointment? Because you don't win every case.
I suppose there's a lawyer out there somewhere who never lost a case, but I think if it's a case, if you take cases that are important enough to take, there are going to be cases that you don't win. That simply happens. I think the key is to understand whether you have done all that you can do for the client. And if you've done that, if you've put your all into that, you didn't win, but you can't be disappointed in the big picture. There's definitely a different feeling that you have when the verdict comes in against you compared to when the verdict comes in for you. But you're a part of a system that makes this country one that has the ability to offer people equality and opportunity, the ability to stand up to the big powers. And being part of that means that sometimes you're not going to succeed because they have resources too, and they have a vote. They have advocates as well. And all of us have been up against excellent lawyers on the other side, which create a system, an advocacy system, that really means that typically ours are jury trials, really means that the jury is most often going to get it right. And the bulk of us are respecting of the fact that that jury is there for a reason, and we trust them. We want a fair jury. And it's one of the reasons why voir dire is as important as it is, trying to find out the biases and prejudices of people. But when you do that work and do it well, both sides, then the jury's almost always going to get it right.
So it involves having faith in the jury system, which is fundamental to our system of justice here. You've had so many successes, though. What keeps you going?
The key to that is that there's a challenge, there's a knowledge challenge every day. There is something new to learn every day. There are new approaches to cases that people are synthesizing. They've taken various things that people have done over the years and continue to work on. And so what you knew 5 years ago, what you knew 10 years ago, there's something new to learn this year for the case that you're going to handle next year.
Is there one particular case you'll never forget?
I think for me, the particular situation of the challenge early in the asbestos litigation of the Janssens case, where they were offering us nothing, Johns Manville, the asbestos manufacturer, and we had already lost a previous trial, and Ron Motley and I, or Ron before he came down here to Jacksonville to work with me, had lost several of them. But we were able finally to put the documents in front of and the testimony in front of the that jury. And I recall when we were in the circumstance with no offer on the table, and we're there in my office, just down the hallway here, and Mrs. Jansen's, Patsy Jansen, said to me, Wayne, I know they're not offering us anything, but with to my husband, Ed, that jury just might return a verdict of $1 million and tell us that it was worth it for us to come in here and fight. So from that, I've taken a career lesson of always wanting to listen to my client, because sometimes the clients see the end result as being the justification of their willingness to come and trust you. And if they're willing to trust you, then it helps to push you further into helping them and doing a great job of representing them.
Wayne, along the way through your distinguished career, you have many, many accolades. Just from the Florida Justice Association, the Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award, the B.J. Masterson Award for Professionalism, High Ethical Standards, Perry Nichols Award winner, the most prestigious one the Florida Justice Association gives. Tell us, how has your involvement with the FJA impacted your career?
It's impacted my career by impacting the lives of millions of Floridians. Because without the Florida Justice Association, and I always try to remind myself not to shorten it to the acronym of FJA, because the name of the organization talks about what it really is and what it does. It seeks justice for the people of this state. So what it has meant to me in my career is that it has given my prospective clients the opportunity to continue to pursue their right of access to courts, their right to trial by jury, their opportunity to be treated fairly and evenly in a courtroom where the jury is there and a judge is there to give them a fair opportunity. Without the Florida Justice Association, long ago, we would have lost those important opportunities. They might still be on the books, but so many roadblocks would be in the way that they would be meaningless. And so when you do what I do, which is represent people trying to recover from something terrible that's happened, you appreciate the fact that the Florida Justice Association has protected their right and ability to come to you so you can help them in their time of need.
This is a tough profession, very complex, time-consuming. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
It has worked out really well. I'm fortunate in terms of my wife, Pat, having always been supportive, a great advisor throughout all this time. And for me, it is making a decision that there's going to be time that we set out for family and seeing to it, but being happy about the opportunity to be here in that chair or at that desk, standing up, sitting down, whatever it is, happy about the opportunity. So it's I don't find it a problem to have that balance. I'm always able to keep a positive outlook, I believe, and feel good about what I'm doing.
One doesn't have to short shrift the other.
I don't think it does. I mean, now in the early years, when there's a lot of grinding that goes on to make sure that those who you're working for, oftentimes that they understand the willingness that you have to work. It helps if you have a partner in life who's willing to support that, and I did. But as it's happened, it has. I can't say that it's been all planned out. I can say that it's more than that. It's been just very fortunate.
Wayne, what's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have
concerns? I feel
good
about it. I feel good about the future of it. I think that the more that we are involved in not just the Florida Justice Association, but also the aspects of the Florida bar, it's a unitary bar under the Supreme Court that has a whole range of committees that are there for purposes of improving the profession, helping to shape and protect the rules of evidence, the procedural rules that govern what it is that we do. I believe that as long as lawyers continue to participate, don't just isolate themselves, but continue to participate in helping the profession grow in its professionalism, in its appreciation and insistence upon civility, especially in the litigation, that the future of the legal profession is bright. Obviously, things change, technology changes, everything about it, and there are situations where you have non-lawyer-owned law firms around the world, that's an issue that has to be addressed periodically. I thought it was addressed a while back, but it's still out there. I believe that the future of the practice of law is bright in that people will always need someone to understand their situation and stand up for them. And that's what I view that we do, and that we have, fortunately for us, we have a system that enables them to do that.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
This is debated, I suppose, to a degree, but there's always a way to do it the right way. If you're a lawyer who really wants to achieve for your client and be able to then withstand the appeal that might be coming because you won, mm-hmm. you understand that you don't cross the line. What you do is prepare to find a way to get the judge to allow you to move the line a little bit or a little bit because it is maybe the future of the law. So there's always the opportunity to ask for that. And I feel that it's not a matter of the ends justify the means. The means can help the ends if you do it the right way.
Interesting. What one piece of advice do you have for incoming lawyers?
I think it's that they have to be willing to accept the fact that as talented as they are, that it is work and perseverance that will enable them to be successful on behalf of their clients. If they're not willing to work hard, not willing to persevere for those clients, then it's going to be difficult for them to have the career that some of us have been fortunate enough to have.
Wayne, how would you like to be remembered?
I don't think it is something that I've given any contemplation to. I think that we've been very fortunate in our organization, both state but also nationally, to have leaders who have dedicated themselves to the concept that, well, it's like this. When Ryan Sandberg was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, he gave a great talk. And in it, one of the points he said is the when you hit a home run, you drop the bat, you walk around, put your head down and walk around or run around the bases. What Ryan Sandberg said is that's because the name on the front of the uniform is more important than the name on the back. And that approach is to me the key to it. If you work hard, you do well, you provide benefits to your clients and also protect the system that protects them, then that's, I'd say, enough of a memory or an award for anyone.
Wayne Hogan, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming by.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.